This is Sign Language with Bruce Williams and Doc Goldstein.
Hi, and welcome to episode 178 of Sign Language. Happy New Year, people. This is Bruce Williams from signlanguagepodcast.com.
And this is Doc Goldstein from Fullerton, California.
How are you, Doc?
I'm not bad. It's rainy here and cold. Yeah, Southern California.
It must be that one day of the year.
No, yeah.
You don't get much rain in Southern California.
It's been cold for a couple of weeks, and it's been raining like tonight, last night, and it's raining right now. And
please, please, please define cold.
45, 50 degrees.
Okay, what's that in Celsius?
Oh, I don't know. I'm a Fahrenheit guy. I don't have that in my head. Do you guys use Celsius down there at the bottom of the globe? Do you guys use Celsius?
We do, mate. We do.
Wow. Okay.
So how was your new year?
It wasn't bad. I managed to stay home, which I usually do.
Yep.
I don't go driving and all that stuff and all that craziness. Just a nice quiet night at home.
Nice.
And that's usually how I spend New Year's Eve.
Does LA do a big fireworks thing for New Year's?
Yeah, they do all that, and we don't go to it. But we used to go to the 4th of July is bigger, I think.
Of course. Yeah, right.
But yeah, and where we live, we can hear the fireworks from both Disney and Knott's Berry Farm. We're actually within earshot. So every night at 10 o'clock, we hear fireworks. We don't even notice it anymore.
Yeah, right. That's crazy. I didn't even think of that. Yeah.
I'll give people out there where an idea of where exactly I am. Because Fullerton is right next to Anaheim and Buena Park.
Yeah.
And Buena Park is where Knott's Berry Farm is, and Anaheim is where Disneyland is. So
for the
close.
For the non-Americans amongst us, what's Knott's Berry Farm?
Knott's Berry Farm is kind of like Disneyland, it's a park like that, and it's got rides and really good restaurants and many, many years ago, it was an actual berry farm, I think.
Oh, okay.
And then over time, it morphed into something. When I was a little kid, I used to ride my bike there.
Right.
Which now I'd die if I tried doing that. But, even though I have a carbon fiber bike, I would still die. I have a really cool Trek carbon fiber bike.
Wow, that's a serious bike.
It is. It's a serious bike.
Yeah, nice.
For a not so serious rider.
Excellent. So I thought we'd talk about a few different things today. One of the things that's happened to me over the last month is my API EQ has started misbehaving.
So which model EQ is it?
It is the 5500, which is the stereo version in a 19-inch rack mount case. Four-band parametric EQ. So I think it's a 2 5-50s side by side.
Yes, plus it's got a switch on it that gives you less than 2 dB per selection.
That's right.
For mastering.
That's right.
Yeah, it's meant for mastering, really.
Yeah, you can do times one, times a half, and times a quarter. So basically each of those, dB increments can be halved or quartered from their, nominal value. But what's happened is, and I only noticed this when I was trying to record Shutters Inc., my other podcast, where I'd be talking and all of a sudden my host would say, "Oh, mate, I've lost you." And I had to sort of try and work out why on earth the audio had suddenly stopped. And what I eventually narrowed it down to was that when it happened, if I hit the bypass switch on the one channel of that EQ unit that I was actually running my microphone through, suddenly my audio came back. And so I was doing some testing once we'd finished recording where I was just talking to myself. And I noticed as well that because I generally don't run my headphones very loud, that I wasn't actually noticing that I was losing it in the headphones as well. And if I ran my headphones a little bit louder, I could tell when it suddenly dropped out. And it's just this intermittent problem where every now and again, it will just stop passing audio through that left-hand channel of the unit.
Oh, okay. So that's the that was my question I've been waiting to ask. Is it both channels? Is it just one channel? It's just one channel, right?
I suspect that it's just the channel that I'm using. I would need to repatch my patch bay in order to run through the right-hand channel, but I suspect that it's only one channel. I'd need to do a bit of testing for that.
So if it's both channels, it could be that your power supply took a hike or you have an internal fuse that you don't know about that died.
Right.
Something simple like that. But if it's one channel, it could be just a wire that was soldered to your bypass switch popped off.
Right.
Or something basic like that.
Yep.
It could be something that simple, you know?
Yeah, right.
It's very rare for API equipment to fail. You know, the stuff is made by people who know what they're doing,
yeah.
you know, back
yeah.
east. And they use good stuff. They don't use cheap switches and crappy wire and all that. So that's unusual.
Yeah.
I really am very curious to see what you find when you take the top off.
I'm a member of a Facebook group called Audio Builders Workshop. Not that I consider myself an audio builder by any stretch of the imagination. I just lurk in there for the odd bits of conversation that I understand. But I posted in there and said, hey guys, this is what's happened. The limit of my hands-on experience with this kind of stuff is soldering my own microphone cables. So is this something that I could approach myself? You know, is it something that I could easily diagnose? And if yes, how simple would it be for me to fix it?
And you know, if it's in warranty, you may not want to touch it.
Oh, no, it's well out of warranty. I've had this unit for about 8 years.
Oh, okay. So the electrons just got tired.
Yeah,
that's all there is to it.
That's it. But a couple of the guys in the group both posted photographs of the internals of the device. One from the earlier generation, and then a second guy posted back and said, "And if you've got one of the newer models, it looks like this." And both of them, you know, highlighted certain areas on the image and said, look for these things here, you know, if anything, you know, looks a bit out of whack, you know, that's probably going to be the problem. And so it's on my to-do list to actually get this thing out of the rack and take the lid off and see if I can diagnose the problem.
So what kind of things did they say that it might be?
I think somebody mentioned power supplies. I think somebody mentioned capacitors. Somebody mentioned dry solder joints, you know, or, you know, joints
yeah.
that just haven't soldered properly. I don't know that it's going to be a solder thing because this thing has worked reliably for 8 years and then suddenly has decided not to. So,
well, you know, okay. So many years ago when I was working for Kenny Rogers, he had a Crown preamplifier and a Crown amp.
Right.
I think it was a DC-300, but he had a preamp, a Crown, I think a DC. Oh, God, I don't remember what model number, but it was the one that matched the DC-300, you know, for people who wanted to run a stereo through an amp like that.
Okay.
Which, you know, there's maybe three people who would want to do that. But it's because it's a really good amp. It's better for control rooms. But anyway, I opened it up, and it had been working, and I found a cold solder joint in there.
Wow.
You know, where the solder kind of created like a hollow sphere around the where the two wires are supposed to be soldered. You know, it didn't actually flow onto the wires themselves, and it was just pure luck that it had,
wow.
that it had ever worked at all. So it could be a cold solder, you know. As far as capacitors, if it's 8 years old, you know, I suppose it's possible that an electrolytic bypass or filter cap in your power supply could have dried up, but
right.
usually that can happen, but 8 years, it shouldn't have happened yet, I would
right.
think.
Right.
I've modified a number of Fender amps where I've switched out all the electrolytic caps in the power supply and rectifier and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you can easily tell just by looking if one of those caps has gone south, you know.
Right. I have a question to ask you.
Yeah.
And that is that this is one of those devices that doesn't have a power switch on the front, which lends me to think that it's designed to just be switched on and left on for a million years. Is the fact that I switch it on and off at the wall all of the time an issue?
I don't think it's an issue, but I do leave big things on, like mixing consoles, you know, large format mixing consoles. I never turn those off.
No.
You know, because it's such a big deal to bring them back up again. But But little things like that, you know, I turn that stuff on and off all the time. You know, I've got a Neve stereo compressor, you know, rack mount, and I've got a bunch of UA stuff, and I have a DBX 900 rack with Aphex EQs and compressors in it. And, you know, I turn that stuff on and off all the time. So,
So are you like me? You've got one big switch that just controls everything in the rack, like a power switch?
I wish I did. I'm not that organized.
That's what I've got. I call it the God switch because it turns on every device that lives in the rack all in one power switch. You know, so
basically, it's probably not that switch. It's probably not
No, it's not that. But I just meant that it's a handy way of just powering up or down everything in the rack in one go. So basically everything in the rack goes into AC power sockets on the back of the rack, and then all of those are routed through this one big rotary knob at the bottom on the front of the rack. So I can just lean down, flick that knob, and I've passed AC power to every device in the rack, which is just a smart, fast way of getting everything powered on or powered off.
Well, a lot of people around here use a Furman box for the in their racks.
Right.
Right. And the Furman is a company that makes a bunch of rack mount 1U boxes that have a couple things in them. They have lights that stick out the front so you can light up your patch bay so you can see what you're doing.
Nice.
But they also have switch on and off or switchable AC on the back, and you can power the whole rack on and off from one of these Furman boxes.
Ah,
and
nice.
Just about everybody I've ever seen that has a racked up stuff has a Furman like that that does that, except for me. You know, one of these days I'm going to get off my sorry butt and rewire my outboard equipment because I've got this really cool Neve V-Series rack, and it's got Elco ins and outs, which is like EDAC, same type of pins. And
okay.
I'm not using it because it's not hooked up right now because since it hasn't been since we moved, so... And we've moved 3 years ago, so I have to get off my butt, you know, and rewire everything. And maybe I'll put in a Furman rack when I do that. But
right,
every roll around rack that I've seen that people bring in for sessions or whatever, they all have at the very top a Furman.
Yeah, nice. You sounds know, like a great idea. You know? Like the lights and the AC is a great combination.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
And there's a surge protector in them as well, which doesn't hurt.
Oh, okay, nice. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So I'd be really interested to hear what's wrong with yours when you get that fixed, you know.
Yeah.
It's going to be something really basic.
I hope so, and I hope it's something that I can fix myself.
Oh, yeah, sure.
A, because it will save me having to spend the money to send it to somebody else, and two, it'll be a nice sense of accomplishment if I do.
You know, one thing I have found in, and I won't say the brand, but at one of the schools I teach at, we have a mixing console, and on the bus outputs, it had coupling capacitors, not power supply, but audio coupling capacitors.
Okay, and what they were role in that?
Well, they're in series with the audio, so they block DC.
Right. Oh, okay, right.
And so they're just coupling caps. But they were rated at 25 volts, and that's really bad because plus and minus 15 is 30 volts, and which is what the console ran at. And you're supposed to have the voltage of a capacitor at least twice what it's ever going to see.
Oh, right?
So we lost a bunch of caps because they were specced and
too low.
And I think that was just the console manufacturer being a cheap, you know.
Yeah, right.
Cheap, just cheap, cheap, cheap. So we put 50s in, and it probably will stay forever now.
Yeah, nice. You know? Wow.
But I bring that up because I'm sure that API would never do that.
No.
You know, there's a difference. There's a reason why the API stuff is a little more expensive than some of the stuff around.
Yeah.
It's because it's built to last. So it's why I'm extremely interested to find out, you know, what happened. I mean, you haven't bounced it down the stairs or anything, right?
No, it's lived in the rack for the 8 years of its existence.
Yeah.
And the rack hasn't moved in the 8 years that we've been in this house. So, no, it certainly hasn't moved, and it's a smoke-free studio. There's really no external influences that I can think of. And that was the only reason why I threw the question of, you know, switching the power on and off. Could that potentially have shortened the life of any of the components? But I didn't expect it to, but I thought, well, maybe it's an influencing factor. But anyway.
Well, I suppose it's possible, you know. is possible, but yeah, you know, the fact that it's only one side makes me think not.
Well, you raise a good point. I will make the make it my task this weekend to just patch the mic into the other channel and see if I'm experiencing any of the same, you know, random dropping in and, you know, dropping out kind of behavior. Just to, you know, at least cross that off the list of potential variables.
That's a wonderful sounding unit, that API.
It is when it's working. I'm not running through it at the moment, of course.
Right, of course.
But yeah, it's a beautiful unit. I love it. I really should use it in mixing. I should pass stuff through it when I'm mixing down.
Oh, I recommend it on snare drum.
Right.
Absolutely. Right. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, hey, you made a comment just before we started recording about the digital age was going to improve something about the way
well,
we work.
Well, okay. Well, you know, I was thinking way back to when this is going so far back that my hair was brown and my teeth were white, which is a joke I've used before that I stole from Graham Edge, the drummer of the Moody Blues, which I think I also said that before. But I always want to make sure I give credit for bad jokes.
Sure.
But, but this was so long ago.
The good ones you'll claim
I remember
ownership
of. when digital was first coming out, and all there was like the SoundStream, which was like a test system that never really hit the market, but it sounded amazing.
Right.
And 3M was, I think they were working furiously to get their unit ready, and I don't think it was out there yet. But I remember thinking early on, oh man, digital will make things so much easier. We won't have to calibrate tape machines anymore. Yeah. You know, I had no idea that I'd have to deal with bad drivers and computers that would want to crash or not cooperate.
Yep.
And sample rates and, you know, mismatches and external sync and all this other crap. You know, I had no idea.
Or software that won't run until you install a mandatory update.
Right. Well, yeah. my computer never needs a service pack.
Oh, okay. Nice. Oh, because Mac doesn't roll out service packs, right?
Okay. That's right.
Well, my retort to that that whole statement about, you know, we thought that digital was going to, you know, save us from all of these things was that when I first got into, you know, this industry as a, you know, an 18, 19-year-old in the mid to late 80s, was in my naivety, I remember thinking to myself, this is awesome. I've found myself a career that will never get overrun by computers. Because I thought there was no way that, you know, we were ever going to move away from tape. I just assumed that we would always have to record on tape, that that's just how it was done. And how little I knew.
You know, what's interesting to me about that is that when people generically refer to digital, they're thinking random access to digital files.
Right.
They're not thinking about like an older digital machine that actually uses tape and has to be rewound and fast forwarded.
Oh, yeah, right.
They don't consider that digital because it's not immediate access like random access.
Like the old Sony Dash recorders.
Yes, of which I had a few.
Right. You know,
I've done a lot of work with 3324s and 3348s. I remember the Talking Head stopped making sense.
Yeah.
The mix on that went to a 3324.
Right.
That we Dolby encoded so it could be run into the optical channel, and the Dolby optical track had to be Dolby encoded.
Okay.
And so it didn't make sense to have to do that for a digital track, but we had to do it because it'd be playback off the optical track in theaters around the world.
So, right, yeah.
But I digress. But yes, those machines used reels. They rewound. You know,
yeah.
we had a Mitsubishi 32 track on 1-inch, and we had a bunch of 3324s and 48s on 1/2-inch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you had to rewind these things.
Yeah.
And I remember Apogee made a ton of money by making alternate converters for the 3348s. Remember that?
Okay. I never worked on the digital multi-track tape machines, no. So.
Yeah.
Basically, I worked on analog multi-track tape and then went straight to Pro Tools. So.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Yeah. And that was a revelation in its day. Like the first version of Pro Tools that I saw was version 3, and it was the first digital audio workstation I had ever encountered. And I don't know if I've mentioned this story to you, but I remember recording this performance with a guy in a radio station for a promo that I was doing, and he absolutely nailed the performance on the first take, but he popped on one word in the performance. And I thought to myself, I could sit here and make him redo this thing, you know, a zillion times to try and get it again, or I'm sure this Pro Tools thing will allow me to get rid of the pop. And what I did was just, you know, went in and, you know, cut around the pop, and I applied a high-pass filter at 120 hertz and, you know, a little bit of volume automation, and completely got rid of the pop, and, you know, would just walk around the building telling anybody who would listen how amazing this technology was.
The very first workstation I encountered was a Digital Audio Research Soundstation 2.
Right.
We paid $80,000, I think, for this thing, and it did 8 tracks.
Yep, and probably only did 16-bit at most.
That I don't remember. And yeah, it was made by the same people that made WordFit, which we used on that Dune motion picture, the David Lynch film.
Yeah, right.
And it was really expensive, but it worked really good. It had a great scrub feature on it, but it was so expensive. That's how things were back then.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I was only telling my son Max a couple of days ago that I remember this would have been middle of the 90s, around about, I'm going to say 94 at a guess. I remember the owner of the radio station I was working at the time telling me what a great deal he had got on a 9 gigabyte SCSI drive for $3,500.
Wow.
And my son just looked at me and went, 9 gigabytes? And I went, yeah, mate. I said, back in those days, that was an insane quantity of storage.
That is crazy.
He struggled to get his head around that.
Do you remember when blank CDs were selling for like $17?
Yes, they were $30 Australian, yeah.
Oh, my God. And we made money on that, you know, yeah, for about 5 minutes.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
What were they? Udens. They were Udens.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
And man, has that gone away. Oh, so every time you come up with a business that'll make money, it disappears and gets replaced by something, you know, which is the way it is. You have to keep your ear to the ground.
That's exactly right. Now, look, we still have some topics that William LaForge sent us a thousand years ago. One of them was tracking and mixing techniques.
So in the box or out of the box? Let's make that distinction.
That's a good point. Let's start with out of the box.
Okay.
Obviously, tracking techniques absolutely start with great microphone choice and great microphone placement. Obviously, you know, the best signal chain you can put together for whatever it is that you're recording.
I remember back in the day, people who really wanted a clean sound but they had an older console, they'd patch out of the mic preamp straight into the tape machine,
yep,
to bypass all of the extra transformers and amplifiers that were in the console. So for those out there who might be purists, which I'm not, but if you are,
yep,
that's one way to get rid of a lot of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
You can bypass a lot of stuff by patching right out of the mic pre straight into the recorder. For the sake of this conversation, though, should we assume that the recorder is some sort of DAW?
Yes.
Okay.
And of course, once you've bypassed that old analog console and you've recorded to your DAW, you can then use 50 tape emulation plugins on the way out.
Right. So we used to work really hard to make sure that what we recorded came back the same way.
Yeah.
And now the digital automatically does that. Now we're trying to go the other direction and make it sound worse.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, it's crazy.
I've got to admit, though, I do like them. You know, I've got things like the Waves J37 tape machine plugin.
Yeah, that's a good plugin.
I love that on bass guitar. I love it on things like tambourine, which can sometimes be a little harsh sounding, and I find that tape plugin just softens the transients a little.
Now, do you use a real tambourine or are you using a sample?
No, a real tambourine.
Wow. Congratulations. You're analog. Me too, by the way.
Yeah.
Me too.
Dave has a couple of tambourines in his cupboard, so when we do tambourine, he actually does play the tambourine. We don't use a sample.
That's better.
Yeah.
But then I do find myself going back and using Tab to Transient a lot and making sure my tambourine is close to sync with the snare.
Well, I was going
to say, it doesn't have to be exactly. It's got to be at least close.
So here's, you know, here's my little trick on that. I will let Dave play the tambourine for as much of the song as he feels it needs. And when it comes to mixing, I will generally go through that tambourine performance and I'll find maybe four different bars where he was absolutely on it, on the grid, and I'll cut those four bars. And then I'll just loop like on, and I'll slot them up, you know, on the grid so that they're side by side. So I've got four perfect bars back to back that are on the grid that are edited to the grid. So there's absolutely, you know, no overlap. And then I'll copy and paste those along the length of the performance. And what that does is it gives me a tambourine that stays on the grid right through, but it's four different bars of performance. So, you know, you might get a slightly different intensity of hit.
So it still sounds like a person did it. That's
exactly,
really good.
Exactly.
You know, unless you're not using a grid and then you have to do it the hard way.
Well, we always work to the grid because the way Dave and I work is that when I go up to his place and we're going to start working on a new song is, first of all, he'll start playing the song like he just sitting beside me with his acoustic guitar. And what I'll do is I'll hit Reaper with the tempo, the metronome switched on. And it has on the metronome in Reaper, you have a button that says tap. And you can just click it with your mouse in time with Dave as he's playing the song to me. And Reaper will resync to that tempo, right? It'll set the project tempo to however rapidly you hit that tap button. So if it turns out that the tempo is, you know, 103 beats per minute, then we've got our project set at 103 beats per minute. And then what I'll do is I'll just slap one mic in front of him to do an acoustic performance of the song, but he'll have the headphones on so he's got the metronome in his ears. And that way we get just a rough guide vocal and guitar that's on the grid because he's got the metronome. And then we start building the entire performance. You know, we'll work out what we're going to use for drums, and then he'll lay down a bass track, and we just build it up piece by piece to that guide performance, which was done to the metronome. And so that way we end up with the song that sits on the metronome all the way through, but, you know, we can introduce all of that human variation as we go on each individual track.
Well, Pro Tools will let you tap a tempo as well.
Right.
There's also a plugin that I like called Echo Boy by Soundtoys.
Oh, yeah.
And you can, if you're doing delay on that, you can tap that as well if you want. So that works out really well.
I'm assuming that would also have the ability to chase whatever tempo is in the session?
I haven't done that.
Right. Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if it does, but I haven't done that, to be honest with you.
Because there's a plugin in the Waves Gold Bundle called H Delay, and it has the option to chase the tempo of the session. So so you can set it to half beats, quarter beats, dotted eighth notes, whatever length of delay that you want. And if you've chosen the option host, it's called host, that will basically use the tempo of the session as the 1x, if you like, of the tempo. And so if you've then chosen eighth notes, it'll then work out what an eighth of the session tempo is and apply the delay at that repetition.
Well, I've used that plugin, but I haven't used that feature.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I use that all the time. So if I'm going to use that particular delay plugin, I'll always set it to host so that it's looking at the tempo of the session, and then I'll choose, you know, dotted quarter notes or whatever it is that I want in terms of a length. But it's always relative to the session tempo.
So what we've proven so far is that different engineers work differently and it's okay.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, I tell my students that I might choose a different microphone than a different teacher has chosen for something that we're doing.
For sure.
And that's okay. It's to Coy Allen Parsons, it's an art and a science, right?
Mate, I think people get hung up way too much on reading up about, you know, microphone X on the interwebs and going, oh, you know, all of these engineers claim that this microphone is the absolute go-to for snare or for vocal or for whatever. And it's like, but everything's relative to the voice that you're putting behind that microphone. It's relative to the room that you're in. It's relative to the mic pre you're running it through. There are so many variables that it makes no sense to get hung up on what you read on the interwebs and thinking that that must be the gospel truth.
So somebody's going to write in and ask which is the right preamp for tambourine. And I'm going to quote Cyndi Lauper's bass player, who said on a forum, whatever preamp you had last, you know.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, and he knows. He's very good, and he knows. So that's very funny to me. Yeah. And I use that line sometimes, you know. But again, I give credit where credit is due. You know, he said it.
Any other tracking techniques that you think are worth mentioning, Doc?
Well, it depends on the workstation, but Pro Tools HD has a nice feature where on their high-def converters, they have like a soft clip in there, similar to what Apogee used to have, so you can't clip your converters if you have somebody who all of a sudden decides to not pay attention to level.
Oh, okay.
And it's clipping. The converter actually will not let it clip. It'll do a soft limit at the last minute.
And nice.
At the school, I don't have that set up at home, but I have it set up at the school because, you know, students. And it's saved us a few times.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You got to make sure that you don't have latency. If you have any kind of latency in your system,
yes,
and you have somebody trying to overdub, it will absolutely drive them nuts.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is a good practical joke to play on somebody, I might add, you know?
As long as you know how to get rid of it at the drop of a hat.
My favorite practical joke is to put a harmonizer in line with their cue feed so that, you know, they hear everything, down or up, you know.
Down a half semitone.
Yeah. It's just great.
What I was going to say is something that I've been experimenting with only in the last 2 or 3 months that I'd never done up until now is to use a feature that is certainly in Reaper and it's probably in Pro Tools and it's probably in every other DAW as well. And that is to use plugins on the input chain. So in Reaper, you have the normal effects plugin slots that appear on the Reaper mixing console. So, you know, for your vocal track, you've got your effects insert slots as well as your sends. But on top of that, where you assign your inputs and you enable a track to record, there's another button called Input Effects. And what that allows you to do is to load, you know, VST effect and pass the signal through those VSTs before the audio is written to hard drive. So it's essentially baking in the effects as you record. And this is not something I've done up until now, but in the last session that Dave and I did, I started experimenting with that using the Waves SSL G channel strip as an inline effect during tracking.
And so I have that Waves SSL package. I use it all the time.
So do I. I love it. And the reason I started doing it was because it occurred to me that as I was mixing, you know, the album that we're currently working on, I was always reaching for that SSL G channel, particularly for the lead vocal track, and generally for the backing vocal subgroup. And I thought to myself, if I'm reaching for this every time I mix, I should probably just track with the damn thing. And so the last session that we did, I actually did that and I used it as an inline effect. And I love the fact that I could get some of that compression during the recording, which meant I could, you know, print a little hotter than I would normally print because I always like a margin of error. And so being able to run through that compressor as I was recording meant I could run the input a little hotter than I had previously. So, yeah, so that's something that I've been experimenting with of late.
Some workstations, if you try doing that and you're recording directly into your audio channel, when you punch into record or go to input, it'll bypass the plugin. And the way around that is to bring your microphone in on an aux track and send that through an aux bus to an audio track. And then you can have your plugins on the aux track and they won't bypass.
Ah, that must be a Pro Tools thing. I've never seen that happen with Reaper. Safety feature for some reason or what?
I don't know, but it drives me crazy. You know, like it. And it's funny. Sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. So I haven't, it might be version related. I have to look at that. But usually I'm so busy, I just get it working and move on.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm in an interesting situation now because one of the schools where I'm teaching at, they have an SSL duality console.
Right.
And, at home I have the Waves SSL package, which I've said I use all the time. Mm-hmm. And I have not been able to AB that with UA's version of it, by the way, case anybody wants to know. But it's interesting. I have not taken my iLock to the school to see if that package sounds exactly like the console, but it seems to me that it doesn't, that it sounds pretty close.
Right.
But not 100%. I think maybe 90%.
Okay.
Which is what I find of plugins, typically, that they sound a lot like what they're emulating, but not exact.
Right.
But I think they're getting better over time, and I wouldn't be surprised if, in a few years, they don't sound exact. Because, digital and analog technology is so different.
Yeah, for sure.
I remember there was a time when UA had TDM plugins that would work. They had an 1176 plugin that would work in Pro Tools, and they don't have that anymore.
Glad you've mentioned the 1176. I'll let you finish, but I want to come back to that.
Okay. So this plugin did not sound like an 1176. It worked like one, just like the BF76 looks like one and works like one, but doesn't exactly sound like one.
Right.
I still used it because I'm familiar with an 1176 and I knew how to get what I wanted out of it, but it didn't have that thing.
Okay.
Hardware 1176s have this thing in their tone that I haven't found in a plugin yet.
Okay.
And I have three 1176s, so I know of what I speak.
Yeah, right.
In fact, I have one for sale if you're interested.
Well, the thing I wanted to mention about the 1176 that I only discovered in the last month, and I was absolutely mortified when I learned it because I was like, how have I gone this long and not known this one thing about the 1176?
What, and the all-in thing?
No! The fact that the attack time and the release time are opposite to every other frickin' compressor that's ever been built.
Oh, yeah, and they're opposite to each other as well.
Well, no, but they're fastest when they're turned clockwise instead of counterclockwise. Like on every other compressor, the shortest attack time is when the knob's turned anti-clockwise. But on an 1176, the fastest attack time is when it's turned fully clockwise.
Well, on mine, the fast attack is when it's anti-clockwise.
Really?
Yeah.
They're numbered 1 to 7, correct?
Oh, hang on. I have to turn on a light. I'm sitting in a dark room.
Right. Because...
let's see. Hang on. I have to open up a rack. Which I can't do right now without taking my headphones off.
Okay. That's fine.
Okay.
So it turns out that... The attack.
But mine is an old one. It might be different than the new ones. Mine is like 25 years old.
Yeah, well, I think that's what everyone thinks of when they think of an 1176. But the attack time knob is labeled from 1 through 7, where 1 is, anti-clockwise and 7 is, at the fully clockwise position. And I just always assumed that, like every other compressor, the fastest attack time was when it's wound anti-clockwise. And then I was reading this blog post about, classic compressors or something like that, and the person writing the blog post had made this claim that on an 1176, the fastest attack time is when the attack knob is wound fully clockwise to the 7 position. And I thought, nah, that can't be right. And I you know, got to my Reaper and I dragged in, you know, something like a bass guitar, something that, you know, sustains well. And I thought I can use this to test that theory. And sure enough, when you wind the attack knob clockwise, the attack gets faster. And the same goes for the release. The fastest release is when it's fully clockwise. And I was like, what?
Well, that's a plug-in.
Yeah.
It's not the real unit.
I understand that it's a software emulation of a hardware unit, but I would have assumed that if they were trying to emulate a hardware unit, they would have stuck to whatever was the convention with the hardware unit.
Okay, so I'm going to have to go look at mine and see if I've been crazy, but mine, the attack, when it's fully anti-clockwise, is fast, but the release is the opposite.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. I have said I've got three of them, right?
Yeah.
Well, one of them is an old unit that I got when I retired. They gave it to me.
Oh, nice.
And the other two that I have are actually a unit that they sell now called a 2-1176, and it's two 1176s in one box, in one two-rack mount box.
Nice.
And this one, instead of having push buttons, has rotary knobs on it.
For the ratio?
Yeah. Now, I've compared the sound of this to my old one, and it sounds pretty similar, so I don't have any problems with it. But now I'm going to have to go back. So this thing says fast at the most clockwise position of the attack knob.
Right.
Okay. And hang on a second. The attack time. And it says, yes, on both the attack and release time, it's got fast at the fully clockwise position all the way down.
Yeah.
Past, because this is labeled 1 through 9, and then it says fast.
Right.
And it's the same for both attack and release, but I don't think my rack mount unit is that way, which I haven't used in a while, but I don't think it's that way. I think they're backwards from each other.
So maybe this is just a case of an inconsistency with all of the hardware units. Maybe they're not all identical.
That'd be a nightmare, but it would be easy to do back when they were soldering pots on.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm thinking. But yeah, it just blew my mind when I read that.
Well, the first thing I would do was I would check the plug-in against hardware and see if it follows.
Yeah, well, like I said, I don't have access to a hardware unit, so...
But well, buy mine, then it solves the problem. You know, I was telling some students the other day, and it hadn't occurred to them, you know, because somebody was drooling about some hardware in some magazine, because the marketing never stops with all this audio equipment, right?
Yeah.
And I said, you know, if you buy that, you only get the one instance, and that had never occurred to him.
Yeah.
You know, you can put one on every channel if you have it as a plug-in.
That's right.
But if you buy the hardware, you got one channel, maybe two if it's a stereo unit. By the way, I do not advise using 1176s as bus compressors, by the way. I don't think they sound good for that.
No, unless you want a really hard, crunchy sound.
Or dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty, yeah.
I do want to ask you a question about your 2-1176.
Yes.
You mentioned that it substitutes the push buttons for the ratio with rotary knobs. So
correct.
Are those rotary knobs stepped or are they continuous?
Ah, that's a good question. They are continuous.
What? That's not an 1176.
Yeah.
It can't be.
Hang on a second. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's that you can relax. It's the attack and release that are continuous. The
right.
The ratio is stepped.
Right.
And it's got a 1, 4, 8, 12, 20, and an all position. So it's got an all buttons in selection.
Yep.
Even though it's on a rotary knob.
Oh, okay. You know? Interesting.
And I use that all positioned on drums. I use it on drum overheads.
Yeah, right. I've read lots of guys saying exactly that the all buttons position is great for drums. So,
yeah.
Yeah, right.
But I haven't bothered to find out exactly what it's doing. So I'm lazy.
My understanding is essentially it's just, you know, like maximum ratio. Essentially, it's a peak limiter to the extreme.
Could be.
Anyway.
I love the 1176 for the speed of its attack time. Sometimes you want a really fast attack time.
There is nothing quicker.
And man, it is. It's fast. It's in the microseconds.
It is. Just for those who don't know, the fastest attack time on an 1176 is 20 microseconds, not milliseconds, microseconds. And that is 21 millionths of a second. And its slowest attack time is 800 microseconds, which is 0.8 of a millisecond. It is stupidly fast.
Yeah.
So what about mixing techniques, Doc? Anything of special import that you think we should share?
Again, it depends if we're talking in the box or out of the box. But I have a template that I use that I teach my students when they're mixing in the box. So that instead of bouncing a mix out and then dragging it into a track, they can mix within Pro Tools and punch into record and actually record a track that way, which is better than doing a bounce, because that way you can stop if you hear something you don't like and you don't lose control while the workstation is bouncing. And you can bounce offline to save time. And it's easier to put bus compression or any kind of bus plug-in on an aux track that's controlling your mix track. There's all kinds of advantages that you can do that I use that template for. I might bounce out the final mix after I've recorded it so that to take it to mastering, but when I'm actually recording the mix, instead of...
Yep.
I'll actually record it inside the session by using aux buses and things of that nature.
Oh, so that you end up with a mix two track on a track of its own inside the session.
Exactly right.
Ah, okay, right.
Which reminds me, and this is, you know, strictly for those guys who are using Pro Tools, you know, I know that not everybody does, and that's fine. But in Pro Tools, almost all of the tracks have the inserts ahead of the fader, so that if you have compressors on your insert bus on a channel, and then you move the fader, which is the output of that channel, or you do volume automation, either one, same thing. That's happening after the compressor, so it doesn't mess with your threshold. And that's important. But a lot of people don't seem to realize that the master fader in Pro Tools is not like that.
Right.
The fader is before the inserts on a master track. So if you have a compressor on a master fader and then you move the fader, you've just screwed up your threshold. So I don't use master faders when I mix.
Right.
Ever.
Right. Interesting.
I don't use them. So think about that. And for those of you who are scratching your head right now, just try it. You know, put something on a master track, get a good level on it, put a compressor on the insert bus, and then watch your compressor's meter as you lower the fader on the master track and watch it move. Watch it mess up your input threshold, you know. That's bad.
Yeah, because it means that as you lower the master fader, the compression is actually backing off.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's another thing. I typically don't use master faders.
Right. Interesting.
But that's me.
When you say you don't use them, you mean you have one in the session, but you never touch the master fader. Is that what you mean? Or you don't actually have
one? I don't even have one in the session. No, I don't. Right.
Wow.
And I've also found that they add a bunch of latency. So I really don't have them in the session when I'm overdubbing somebody.
Right.
Unless I don't like that person.
Yeah, right. So that is, you raise an interesting point about where the inserts, certainly at the track level, not at the master level, but at the track level, where the inserts appear in relation to the channel fader. And one of the features that I love about Reaper is you have a regular volume envelope, but there is another envelope called volume pre-effects. And what that allows you to do is to create some volume automation that occurs before the signal is passed to any VST or, you know, DirectX plugins that you've got in that track. And the reason I like that is that if you've got a particularly dynamic, let's say a vocal, you might set the compression threshold for that track on the quiet part of the vocal, and you know the compression sounds really nice, but then when you get to the louder part of the vocal, suddenly you're absolutely slamming the input side of the compressor and driving it into a much, you know, more aggressive amount of compression, and maybe more than you wanted. Conversely, you might set the threshold for the compressor for the loud part of the vocal, and then find that on the soft part of the vocal, there's almost no compression happening at all because the signal's not reaching the threshold of the compressor. And so this, this volume pre-effects envelope, which appears on every track in Reaper, allows me to create just some crude automation for the loud and soft parts of a vocal so that all of the vocal performance is hitting the threshold of the compressor at it within a nice range. You know, obviously there's going to be a little bit of variation, but it's more within a consistent range than it was without that envelope to modify the signal hitting the input of the compressor.
That's a nice feature. That's a nice feature. I like that.
It is really good. Now, the way to get around that, if you're in a DAW that doesn't offer that feature, is to simply create an aux bus and put the compressor on that, and then feed your voice, you know, if it's a vocal that you're trying to compress, into that aux bus, and then use the VO channel fader to ride that level. And that essentially does the same thing. It allows you to do some crude automation on the vocal before it hits the input of the compressor. And then, you know, you might then automate the output of the compression aux bus as well, if you needed to, you know, then ride that fader post-compression as well.
You know, I do a similar but different thing. I probably get a similar result, but what I often do is if I want a lot of compression on a vocal, but I don't want all those artifacts, I don't want to hear the sound of the compression, I'll use two compressors in series. Typically, I'll use what my students call the dock sandwich. You know, I'll put like a I'll put an equalizer ahead of the compressor, and I'll use a high-pass filter to get rid of everything below 100 because, you know, there's nothing below 100 but trouble on a vocal, right? And, I'll, you know, I might do a little bit of EQ if there's something I have to notch out that's really a problem, you know, because I don't want to put that through a compressor and have it be magnified. And then I'll put a compressor on and do just a little bit of compression, and then I'll put an EQ after that that is gonna make it prettified. You know, this is why I put lipstick on the pig. And then I will compress the result. Then I'll probably also use volume automation and ride that vocal. So a lot of times I'll make a vocal sound much more intimate by reversing the envelope of the dynamics of the vocal with that fader. So I'll get partway there with the compression, but then I'll ride the vocal so that if somebody sings soft, I bring that up. When they sing loud, I bring that down. So it makes a singer sound like they're singing right in your ear. It's very intimate, you know, that way. And that works great.
I've got to say, over the last 3 or 4 months, whilst I've been in the mixing phase for this album of Dave's that I'm working on, one plugin that I have overlooked grossly over the last 10 years, and I've just kind of rediscovered it and I'm using it a lot now, is the Waves MV2, which is a compressor that allows you to do bottom-up rather than top-down compression.
Oh, what a nice idea. That is a nice idea. Because so you're letting that plugin do what I just described, essentially.
So you're letting the top side of the transients remain as they are, but then you're sort of compressing the lower-level stuff and bringing that up. So it's a sort of a bottom-up compression approach rather than squashing everything down from the top. And I've been finding that particularly on vocal, you know, if you've got some soft phrasing within a passage that can be quite troublesome to try and get it to sit in a mix when, you know, when you've got a really dense mix, that MV2 compressor just sort of brings up all of that lower level stuff and just makes it a little easier to get it to sit in the mix nicely.
That sounds fantastic. That sounds like, you know, a plugin doing what I was doing before. That's really great.
Yeah, and that's part of the gold bundle. It's been there for 20 bloody years, and I really only rediscovered it about 4 or 5 months ago. And I think again, I was just reading a blog post, and you know, someone made mention of the way it does this bottom up compression, and I thought, wow, I should really explore that. And the minute I did, I went, wow, this is actually really useful to have. You know, it's not what you need on every mix, and it's not what you need on every track, but in the times when that's the issue, it's just a great little plug-in for doing that.
Well, that's nice on a ballad.
Exactly.
Another way to get there, if you don't have that, is you go ahead and let the compressor turn down the stuff that's getting loud. And then you use your makeup gain to turn the result up. And so now you've turned down the soft stuff. You've turned down the loud stuff, so it's closer to the volume of the soft stuff.
Yep.
And then when you raise everything up with gain makeup, now you've got a track where the soft stuff is just as loud as the loud stuff, because the loud stuff's being crunched.
Yeah.
And that works really good. That plus gain writing.
Yeah,
during the mix works really great. And I do a lot of gain writing as well when there's something that might get in the way of the vocal. You know, like if there's a guitar and he plays a solo and then maybe does a harmony sustain during the second verse or something like that, I'll step on it a little bit so it doesn't upstage the singer.
Yeah. The other plugin that I've been using a bit lately, and again, it's been around for years and years and years, is Vocal Rider, which is, you know, designed to be an automatic fader ride plugin. And so what I will do, as I mentioned earlier about the whole volume pre-effects envelope, is I'll do that first. If I've got a really dynamic vocal, I'll do that volume pre-effects envelope first, just to kind of get everything into the ballpark so that it's hitting the input to a compressor at a reasonably consistent level. And I'll have a compressor plugin in the chain, and then I'll throw Vocal Rider in the effects chain of that vocal track after the compressor. So anything that's still just a little bit soft, Vocal Rider will lift up. And again, just all of these things just working, you know, in little increments, I find that by the time I get to the end of the chain, I've got a vocal that's just sitting right in the pocket where I want it.
Well, I think you and I are doing the same thing. And we're getting there in similar but different ways because, again, and this is for the listeners, you know, all three of you, if you have a vocal that's really has a lot of dynamic range to it, it really is going to sound like Amateur Night. It really is.
Yeah.
So if you're able to control that dynamic range and use multiple means to do it instead of relying on just one compressor, whether it be hardware or software, If you use multiple means, just a little bit on each one of those things, you don't hear the compression so much.
Exactly.
You know? And it really can make a big difference. Another thing that I will do, and this is good for hardware or software, I might put a vocal through an 1176 in operating fast to get rid of just really quick peaks, and then put the result through the LA-2A and make it, and just to give it that warm, smooth, softer compression, you know?
Yep.
And then I still might gain ride it after that. And again, to bring up the soft stuff. So it really is a difference between a mix that sounds like Amateur Night and a mix that sounds like a professional mix.
Now,
it really is.
Yeah. Now there was something that you said about 15 minutes ago, and I can imagine there were people who were listening to this podcast going, but what about that bit? You need to address that. And I thought that's the elephant in the room.
What's that?
EQ and compression. Which order should they go in?
Well, it depends what you're going to do. So first of all, every rule could be broken, but here's what typically works for me.
Yep.
And I want to say for me, okay?
Yeah.
If I've got stuff in that track that I don't think is good and I don't want it to be part of the final track, I'm going to get rid of that with EQ before I put it into a compressor. Because if I put it into a compressor, and remember, a compressor is going to make all the soft stuff sound about the same volume as the loud stuff, it's going to make the bad stuff worse.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put my high pass filter before the compression. If there's some kind of thing at right at 3K that is really annoying, you know, that the singer has, like, you know, maybe he's whistling through his teeth or whatever it is, you know, I'm going to notch that out and I'm going to get that vocal clean EQ wise. And then I'll compress it so that I have less dynamic range. And then after that, I'll use compression as more of a musical thing with lower Q, peaking curves and, yep, you know, things like that. And then I might or might not compress next before it goes to the fader where I will then gain ride it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's what works for me usually.
Yeah.
However, you know, sometimes you might get a singer that it works better with no compression. You can't be like a robot and say, oh, it's a singer, and start hooking up a bunch of stuff.
No.
You can't think of it that way. You have to let the music take you where it wants to go.
Absolutely.
And I know that really sounds corny, okay? That sounds like pie in the sky, you know, bullshit out of a marketer's handbook. But it's true, you know. The music, if you let it, will kind of tell you where it wants to go unless it's bad. And that happens. It's badly arranged, or it's a bad, or it's just bad, you know. So people who think that I'm wrong, fine, but it works for me.
I think the key takeaway there is that you do have to assess every instance on a case by case basis. That you can't assume that because it's instrument X, my approach must be approach X, and because it's instrument Y, my approach must be approach Y. It really does come down to what does the song want, and, you know, what's going to serve the purpose, you know, on this particular occasion.
Well, it's really funny because my students always ask me that. What should I do if this happens? You know, and I say, look, they're very disappointed to hear that there's no, in this case, always do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, a monkey could mix it if it was like that.
That's right.
Right? In fact, a monkey might do a better job than me if it was like that. So
let me tell you, kids, we don't ever want to get to a point where audio absolutely has an answer for every one of those questions, because the moment it does, AI is going to do us all out of a job.
Well, stay away from those ads on the internet that say, oh, you know, send me your song and a couple of bucks and I'll send it back to you all mastered. Oh, God.
Yeah, no. Wrong. Yeah. Well, look, Doc, it's been great to chat, mate.
Did we answer any of his questions?
Well, we discussed tracking and mixing techniques. So, I mean, I'm sure there's a million other things we could talk about, but we've been going for over an hour now. So,
okay.
I figure they've had enough by now.
By the way, tonight I'm using for the first time a Shure Beta 57, which I don't usually use.
Okay. So, what made you choose the Beta 57?
It was handy.
Okay. Excellent. Well, I'm only hearing it over Skype at this point, so I'm not going to pass judgment on whether it's good, bad, or otherwise. I'll wait until I get your voice track and I can then see how it sounds, but I'm sure it sounds great.
I do have a pop filter in front of it.
Right.
And I have it rolled off at 100 hertz because I always do that when I record the podcast, no matter what mic I'm using. Yep. I have a high-pass filter in there. It's a Sonics, by the way, Sonnox.
Okay.
Which is the old Sony Oxford plugins.
Oh, okay. Cool.
That's what I use for filtering out because they're smooth.
Excellent. All right. Well, the last thing I'm going to throw into this podcast before we sign off is a YouTube video that I saw a couple of months ago that I made a note of. I just thought it was something interesting and quirky and definitely worth a couple of minutes of your time. There's these guys that built this crazy large compression horn driver and took it out into the desert and then blew an air horn through it and could hear it from 2 miles away. So I'll put that in the show notes for anyone that wants to watch that and have a little giggle, because I thought it was cool.
Yeah, I want to see that.
Yeah. Well, Doc, great to catch up, mate. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
And we will we'll talk again soon.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Sign Language. Another audiotoyou.com quality podcast. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@signlanguagepodcast.com.